So I've just started the recording now. So if anyone is madly unhappy about that, then please say so now. That's okay, Julie.
Thank you.
Can't be helped, but we know you'd have if you could. Right. Okay, so let's get going. So who have we got on this call? Well, we invited groups from all over England and Wales, particularly in places where there are sort of aviation campaigns going on, where there are airports, where there's a threat of them being expanded. So I think we've got a few groups here from the sort of Leeds Bradford Airport region, the Gatwick Airport area, Luton and Southampton airports, as well as obviously Heathrow. So missed any off there? Pop it in the chat box, but I think that's about the size. So you're all extremely welcome here, and great to see you all. So on this call, we've also got a bunch of staff members from Friends of the Earth. So we've got Katie DeCower, who is our lawyer. We have Jenny Bates, who is our transport campaigner. And we also have Dave Timms, who is our senior political campaigner. And also on this call, hiding away, not one of the presenters, she's on this call, is my colleague Brenda, who's similar job to me down in the South region, a regional campaign organizer over there. Okay, so what's this all about? So tonight's webinar is to spend a little bit of time sort of looking at and discussing the Supreme Court ruling around the Heathrow expansion, thinking about what this means for our campaign around Heathrow, what the next steps are going to be, and also what that might mean in terms of the sort of the wider implications for aviation more widely around the UK, which is why we've invited lots of you here. The format of this session is going to be a few short sort of talks, should we say, to begin with. So Katie's going to give us a bit of an overview of the legal case, and a bit of reflection on the Supreme Court results. Then we're going to hear from Dave, who's going to give us a bit of an analysis of the political situation surrounding all of this. And then Jenny is going to talk a little bit more about sort of wider implications around sort of climate policy, things like the sixth carbon budget and that sort of thing. So we'll give you quite a rounded flavor of things through those talks. And then we're going to spend a bit of time on discussing some of the questions which lots of you have sent in advance. So thanks for sending those in. We're going to spend about 15 minutes going through a bunch of those. We won't have time for all of them because we had a lot of questions, but we're going to get through a fair few of those. And then we'll also have some time for some questions from the floor as well before we sort of wrap up. So I hope that sounds good to everybody. And what we'll do now is hand over to Katie DeCower, who is our lawyer at Friends of the Earth. So over to you.
Thanks, Ted. Just to echo what Ted said, it's really, really nice to see you all. Thank you very much for giving up your evening for this. So as Ted said, I'm one of the lawyers at Friends of the Earth who worked on the Heathrow Judicial Review Challenge. I'm going to give a broad overview of the Supreme Court judgment and what it means, and touch briefly on the planning stage, which is what's coming next as well. So I'll have a look at the give an overview of the proceedings, think about what this litigation has achieved, and then look at the planning stage. So in terms of the proceedings, as I expect you're all aware, back in October, this case went before the Supreme Court. It was a two-day hearing, 7th to the 8th of October. It was a remote hearing before five judges of the Supreme Court, 4 Lord Justices of Appeal and 1 Lady Justice of Appeal. And the two parties defending the appeal were Friends of the Earth and Plan B Earth. And the appeal was brought by a commercial developer, Heathrow Airport Limited, which owns and operates the airport site. And this appeal really was very much about commercial interests against climate justice. And I say that because the Secretary of State had been involved in the proceedings in the High Court and then in the Court of Appeal, but they had withdrawn after the Court of Appeal's judgment. So this really was a commercial interest challenge. And we went into that appeal having had a groundbreaking win in the Court of Appeal, which was handed down in the February earlier that year. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court did overturn the Court of Appeal's findings. Friends of the Earth had found, focused our arguments in relation to Section 10 of the Planning Act, which concerns the sustainable development duty and includes the desirability of mitigating climate change. And in the Court of Appeal, we had successfully argued that this had been breached because the government hadn't considered the Paris Agreement. They hadn't considered the non-CO2 warming impacts of aviation, so things like nitrogen oxides. And also they hadn't properly considered the post-2050 climate impacts. And we'd also had a successful ground of challenge in relation to strategic environmental assessment, again, on the basis that the government hadn't considered the Paris Agreement when it environmentally assessed the project either, or the plan either. So, and Plan B's case had been focused on Section 5(8) of the Planning Act, and specifically that the commitment to the Paris Agreement was itself a part of government policy. All of those arguments had succeeded in the Court of Appeal. We've been before the most senior planning judge in the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Lindblom. And the Supreme Court reversed that decision. And they did it for a variety of reasons, but I suppose for us, one of the more surprising ones was they concluded that the Paris Agreement had actually been considered to some degree by the Secretary of State when it adopted the Airport National Policy Statement, which is the in principle support for Heathrow expansion. This was, we found this quite a surprising conclusion for them to come to this, given that the government itself hadn't ever argued that, and they'd actually been quite candid that they had never considered the Paris Agreement. So that was quite disappointing. In relation to Plan B's ground of challenge, they also concluded that there was a lack of formality as they saw it in the commitment to the Paris Agreement, which meant that it couldn't be classified as government policy for the purpose of the Act itself. So a disappointing result in terms of the case itself. Obviously, we would have loved to have sustained our fantastic win from the Court of Appeal. And it does show the lack of consistency between different judges in their interpretations of legal duties relating to climate change, because we went from losing on everything in the divisional court to winning on everything in the Court of Appeal and then losing in the Supreme Court. And this is perhaps partly boils down to climate litigation being an emerging field of litigation, but that's what it is. But on the other hand, I think it's really important to see this in terms of the practical outcome, which is that this judgment does not give a green light to Heathrow expansion. And I'm going to come on to that in a bit more detail. But for us, it's very much a case of we lost, I suppose, that part of the battle, but to use a military metaphor, the war is very far from over. And we think, given the current context, that there are very strong pieces of or forms of challenge that can be made against any Heathrow expansion going ahead ultimately. So in terms of what the case actually has achieved, well, first of all, this case has been rumbled on for over for over 2 years. The Airport National Policy Statement was adopted in June 2018. And, you know, over 2 years later, no development, no planning stage application has actually been put in. Nobody started building Heathrow. And this really shows the importance of this case, because over that period of time, the picture has changed quite dramatically. So, for example, we now have a net zero target. We used to have an 80% target. Parliament has also declared a national climate emergency. And most recently, and Jenny will go on to speak about this in more detail, but the Committee on Climate Change has advised in its balance pathway scenario, which is its recommended scenario in relation, this is part of its advice on the sixth carbon budget released in December 2020, that there must be no net increase in airport capacity. So it's very difficult to see how Heathrow expansion is actually going to be feasible going forwards. And they've also included other pieces of advice, such as the need to monitor non-CO2 impacts and to set a target in relation to non-CO2 impacts as well. In terms of other achievements of the case, well, it established through one of our grounds of challenge that the project is going to need to be assessed against the carbon reduction targets which are in place at the time that the application is made, as opposed to when the AMPS was adopted. And that's really important because, for example, we now have net zero as opposed to then having 80%. The case is also established, and the Supreme Court judgment makes very clear that full climate arguments can be made and will need to be addressed by the developer at the planning stage. So in a sense, what they've done is moved the arguments about climate change down the track and not really grappled with them in the legal proceedings. But that means that everything is very much up for grabs, and it's not in any way foreclosed by the fact that there is this AMPS there. The case also meant that a court endorsed the Brundtland definition of sustainable development, which emphasizes the intergenerational equity aspect and the need to consider the needs of future generations and to ensure that their rights aren't compromised by development happening now. Another really important aspect is the court made very clear that in assessing the effects of the project itself at planning stage, this would need to include an assessment incorporating emissions from international aviation, which is really important given that these are not formally included, as of yet, at least, in the carbon reduction targets, although it is what the CCC has advised. So again, that's very helpful as well. And then obviously now we are in the run-up to COP26 when the country's trying to supposedly to demonstrate itself to be a climate leader. And the context in terms of aviation has changed hugely as well. Owing to the pandemic, there has been a massive decrease in aviation demand, and it remains to be seen how long-term those effects will be, but it certainly looks like business travel is going to be affected for the long term. So all of that is, you know, a very different context for a developer to put in an application for consent, and none of those features were there back in June 2018. So just looking briefly then at the planning stage, which is what will come next if the developer does want to actually get the ability to start building. And so the Court of Appeals decision had ruled that the Airport National Policy Statement was of no legal effect unless and until it was reviewed and the legal errors corrected. So the Supreme Court's judgment has reversed that. The AMPS is back in effect now. And that means that the in principle support for the policy is there. And that policy establishes a so-called need for aviation expansion in the southeast. In 2019, there was a pre-application consultation stage, which Friends of the Earth fed into. And the next stage will be an application for development consent itself. As and when they put that in, then Friends of the Earth is going to resist that, and we're going to throw ourselves into that. And as I said, the climate arguments are very much there to be made. In terms of when that's going to happen, that's very difficult to predict, really. And I don't know if Jenny is able to shed any light, any further light than what I can here. But I know that in October 2020, for example, Heathrow was quoted as saying that they don't think the that the expansion will be built until 2030. So it's, we're talking about, you know, a period of years for this. And then if, you know, if the worst comes to the worst and the and planning consent is granted, then there's still the possibility of a judicial review being taken against that decision as well. So there's a huge, you know, a huge number of opportunities still ahead for us. And I just want to, in particular, just before I wrap up, recognise the work of the Friends of the Earth West London local group network, who in particular have been resisting this expansion for so many years, and who, with whose support we were able to build this case. So a huge thank you to them, and yes, everything to play for. So something that we should feel, I think, optimistic about and strong about. Thank you, Ted. I think that's it for me.
Thank you, Katie. That was brilliant. Really good to hear and really positive. And just to say before I hand over to Dave, as I've put in the chat there, no need to take lots and lots of notes on all of this. And we'll be able to send round briefings and notes on these talks afterwards. So yeah, don't feel you have to do that. Okay, so I'm going to hand over to Dave Timms next, our senior political campaigner. So it's over to you, Dave.
Thanks, Ted, and good evening, everybody. It's lovely to see you all here virtually. My first comment is to echo what my colleague Katie said, which is everything that we've done has been really in the footsteps of the West London groups who have been fighting this one for decades. And it's really to pay tribute to that, because there would be no cases or court cases or action without that work that's gone on for years and years and years. But the politics of it have been extremely difficult. So I'm going to talk a little bit about politics and where we are on this. And I thought the best place to start was on that vote that Katie mentioned, but of the AirPost National Policy Statement in June 2018, because it just shows how much the parliamentary arithmetic has not been an easy place to fight on this. We saw government with a whacking majority. I think the vote was 415 in favour of the Airports National Policy Statement to 119 against. So that was just 8 Conservative MPs, people like voted against Heathrow expansion, people like Theresa Villiers, Zach Goldsmith, Matthew Offord. Boris Johnson, who had always been implacably opposed to him, promised to lie down in front of a bulldozer. Just foreign secretary, just had to be out of the country on that evening. Just, you know, last minute, got to be in Afghanistan. I mean, if he could have gone further to Mars, I'm sure he would have done to avoid his responsibilities and his statements. But just, you know, completely couldn't be there. I'm sure he was very sorry indeed. And somebody's test just pointed out he flew out from Heathrow, the irony. But that was only on the Labour side. Things were equally depressing. Only 96 Labour MPs voted for the position of the leadership, with 119, coincidentally the same number as the government majority, voting against the leadership in favour of expansion. So the parliamentary terrain has always been extremely hostile on this, and this has always been something we've kind of mulled over as we've been thinking about our steps for this. So how's government kind of policy, government's position over the last couple of years shifted as we've moved through the court process? Well, when we initially won on at the Court of Appeal, the initial response from government was that they are supportive of airport expansion where we are able to deliver it within our environmental obligations. In terms of the, at that point, the chance that Heathrow wouldn't go ahead, they played a flat bat and just said it's very complicated judgment and we'll see what our next steps are. You'll remember government didn't get involved in the Supreme Court. allowing Heathrow to fight that battle on their own. A very shrewd move by government, I think, politically. However, they did continue throughout this period to say that they saw airport expansion generally. This is Baroness Veer, who was the Parliamentary Undersecretary for State Minister, to say airport expansion is a core part of boosting our global connectivity and levelling up the UK. It's always levelling up the UK, isn't it? And government supports airport expansion within our environmental obligations. If we carry on until after, immediately after the Supreme Court decision, government changed its position again. Focusing, we've not really had any comments on airport expansion overall. I suspect they would be the same as they were before the Supreme Court judgment. Really seeing Heathrow expansion as a private sector project, this is Baroness Veer again, that must meet strict criteria on air quality, noise and climate change, as well as being privately financed, affordable and delivered in the best interests of consumers. So very much kind of absolving them of themselves of responsibility for Heathrow Airport, despite the fact that it does require the government's AMPS in order really to get through the planning system. Again, Minister 16th of December reiterated that it's a private sector project, which has to meet those criteria. And if we come right up to date though, interestingly, Baroness Veer, Department of Transport, does say though that in the future when aircraft emit less, it may be absolutely acceptable to take as many flights as one likes. Sometimes we are told that we should not fly, but of course that is just because of the carbon. Actually flying is a very good, quick and efficient way of getting from A to B. So clearly really not doubting the policy of being able to fly ever increasing amounts. I think if we look at Labour's position, I was just going to add Boris Johnson. We've had very little from Boris Johnson since he's been the Prime Minister. The few statements he has made have been unenthusiastic, but obviously walking away from his previous line frontal bulldozers position. His position has been to sort of cast doubts on Heathrow as a proposition, that he doubts that it may ever get through. And his other position has been to talk up Birmingham, to point out how quickly you can get from Birmingham. So obviously not standing by his previous position, but kind of sitting on the fence. Recent polling showing the government neck and neck with Labour is quite interesting in terms of the politics of this, because it actually speculated that his own constituency might be one of those which now becomes a marginal. So I think the politics of a much tighter race between the Conservatives and Labour, if his own seat starts to look vulnerable, could be very, very interesting here. In terms of the Labour Party, to return to them, obviously, the position on expansion was quite strong in the Labour manifesto before the new leadership. And immediately after the election, they took an even stronger position in response to the Court of Appeal decision, really ruling out expansion of Heathrow Airport. Now, we did wonder what would happen with the new Starmer leadership. Starmer himself voted against expansion, but there were several members of the shadow cabinet who had voted in favour. And we'd been trying to push them for some time in various meetings. I think there's a couple of people in this meeting who were in a meeting where we pushed Matthew Pennycook on this position. And we weren't getting response, so we were quite worried about the position they might take. However, fantastically, immediately after the Supreme Court decision, Labour came out really strongly and said that they continued to oppose Heathrow expansion. And we hadn't really expected them to be as unequivocal as that. Now, the big question is, would that mean with a different Labour leadership that we would see a different result within Labour? My view is that we would see a number of Labour MPs switch their position under the new leadership. However, that doesn't really mean that we have a majority in Parliament against Heathrow by a very, very long way, because of course government has a larger majority than it had previously. So the parliamentary maths continue to be really, really difficult, but the real kind of light on the horizon here is the CCC's advice, which Jenny's going to talk about in a moment, of no net airport expansion. key to the parliamentary arithmetic has been, I think, the fact that all parliamentarians have been able to ignore the consequences, champion the expansion of their own airport, wherever they may be, while ignoring the consequences of the net airport expansion. The new CCC advice makes that completely impossible. So politically, it potentially sets any MP who wants to champion airport expansion of any airport anywhere against every other MP who wants to champion their local airport expansion. And that could really, really transform things. So the question is now government is considering the advice of the CCC. What will happen? At the moment, they're not saying how they respond and whether they will incorporate that in parliamentary when they've been asked this in parliamentary questions. In terms of the AMPS, obviously we've now made the case that the time has moved on. The AMPS, the policy as it stands, is now out of date with, as Katie said, net zero and other developments. We've been running a petition to call for that, to call for government to review the AMPS, which they can legally do at any time they want to do it. They can review that. So that obviously would change things. At the moment, they don't seem to be keen to do that. There is also a court case, legal case by another organisation, the Good Law Project, which is trying to pursue them to force them to review the AMPS, which again would have to go back through Parliament and take us back into that difficult parliamentary arithmetic. But I think this CCC advice is a real breakthrough in terms of what we can do with the politics of this. Thank you, Ted.
Brilliant. Thank you, Dave, for those really interesting insights. We're going to go straight over to Jenny Bates now, a transport campaigner, for her insights. Over to you, Jenny.
Hi, everyone. Well, both Katie and Dave have basically said the main thing that that I was going to cover, which is great because it is so central, and that's the Committee on Climate Change's 6th carbon budget advice, saying there should be no net airport expansion. As Dave says, we don't quite know what will happen. You know, if the government accepts the overall 6th carbon budget advice, their central scenario is called a balanced pathway, as Katie mentioned. You know, could they try and accept that, but not the aviation bit? Goodness knows, we don't know. But if they did and they accepted that, that really would be a game changer. That balanced pathway scenario, as I say, the main one that they're proposing, still results in 23 million tons of sort of what you'd call sort of residual aviation emissions in 2050. And that is actually, just for those who are in the know, and I know there are some very knowledgeable people on this call, that is actually similar to the 22 million tons scenario they had looked at, that had been looked at before, as a sort of deeper cut type scenario previously. And what previously was assumed to be needed to achieve that 22 or 23 million tons was zero growth on current levels. They're actually saying that this balanced pathway scenario, the 23 million tons, can be done with a 25% growth in passenger numbers relative to just pre-COVID 2018. So although they say no net runway expansion, they still expect passenger numbers to grow. They have also got a number of other scenarios, two of which are more radical in terms of passenger numbers. They actually talk about a 15% cut in passenger numbers by 2050 on 2018 levels. And so, you know, they are, as usual, they tend to go for a sort of middle way. But it's obviously good to know that even their central one is for no net runway expansion. And as Dave says, you can just imagine that, you know, who's going to want to cut their airport capacity to allow Heathrow to expand, or to allow Gatwick to expand, or anybody to expand. I mean, it's, you know, it hopefully would be completely unthinkable. So we'll see what happens there. There's also something coming up, which is the DfT have been very laggard in all things carbon. Transport is the single biggest sector in terms of climate emissions. But it's the biggest problem in terms of the cuts needed as well, because they just haven't been doing enough. But there is a transport decarbonisation plan, which was expected before Christmas, and now we expect in the spring. How that deals with aviation, we are yet to see. But there is separately an aviation net zero strategy expected. And so we will see what happens with that, because there will be a consultation on that, and we can certainly get you involved and let you know what we're trying to advocate and what we'd be encouraging you to input as well. So, you know, there's a lot happening in this next few months, and we will have to see what happens. But we're in a pretty good position, as everyone has said, from these various points of view. So I think I'll probably leave it there. I could very just briefly say that there is potentially also other arguments when we get to Heathrow and potentially other airports in terms of air pollution. There's some relatively new evidence that shows that very small particles, ultrafine particles, can be found in Heathrow's case all the way in central London from Heathrow. They've identified PMs from Heathrow in central London. And that links to the call we have to try and get the particulate matter requirements should be those relative to the WHO, the World Health Organization standard, whereas currently the EU and the UK standards have been much lower. So there is potential there as well. So I'll leave it there, because I think we've got lots to cover on questions and other things, but that's just a quick bit from me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jenny. Yes, so we're going to go straight into questions now. So as I said, we had a bunch of questions submitted by you guys beforehand. So we're going to tackle those for about 10 minutes or so. And then we're going to open up the floor. So if people have questions here as well, we'll get through some of those. So we'll work our way through as many of these as we can. Those that we don't get to answer today, we will be able to supply answers in a follow-up. So if your question that you submitted isn't answered, we will follow up and provide as best insight as we can on it. So the first question I've got here was sent in by Nick Faraday from Ealing and West London Friends of the Earth. And this question is, what does the Supreme Court judgment tell us? This has been sort of covered a bit. But what does the Supreme Court judgment tell us about the real attitude of the establishment to radical action on climate change? And I'm going to hand over to Dave to see if you have any more to add to what you've already said on that question.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, because it's something we mulled ourselves. And one of the things that I think came out of this case is how, this dreadful word, not used the Supreme Court is to considering climate change at this level. How few cases have made it through to the Supreme Court, and how early we are, in a way, even at this kind of desperate stage of an emergency, or of having these things heard by the highest court in the land. You know, in the High Court and the Court of Appeal, there have been a lot more cases, and Katie is much too professional and disciplined a lawyer to say this, but some of the comments that were made, I'm sure they had no impact on their judicial diligence whatsoever, but some of the comments that were made by some of the Supreme Court judges in passing were, how do we put it, old-fashioned, to say the least. The sort of comments I would have expected to find in a 10-year-old copy of The Spectator or something, you know, that, like, how surely, you know, it imbued, I mean, comments just off the cuff, comments about, well, isn't it all about China and India? And, you know, surely this country is one of the leading countries in the world. It's hard to imagine how we could do much more. I mean, those aren't exact quotes. I haven't written them down. But that line of kind of reasoning from them, and I think it was indicative, I think, of some of the thinking about within the highest ranks of the judiciary about the context within the law sets, and I think my limited experience, and I'm about to cater to, is the kind of further you go up the courts, the more that they sit within the context of the political and social kind of views of the day, and the judiciary don't represent a broad section of society and do come from particular sections of society. So I think it was sobering. The fact that we still have a parliament where we're having to debate the electoral maths of this and be the parliamentary maths in this and be worried about it, I mean, is in itself a depressing thought. But we always keep on fighting, and we don't know how much the recent developments in terms of net zero and COP will have changed some of that electoral arithmetic within parliament. But the more of these cases that go through, I think it will get the higher reaches of the court really thinking about it. But Katie, it'd be good to hear your views on this as well.
Thanks, Dave. Yes, I largely agree with what Dave has said. I think there was certainly a very strong feeling for us that the judges weren't used to grappling with these sorts of issues. From the approaches that they had, as Dave said, it was really quite outdated. I think in that respect, the fact that we have COP26 this year is going to be quite helpful, just as perhaps as a general educator. I think in terms of, I mean, this is a problem generally with diversity within the judiciary, especially, but I suppose, given the judgment from the Court of Appeal was so strongly in our favour, and then, as I said, we lost in the High Court, that doesn't necessarily fit with the idea that the situation entirely gets worse as you go farther up, because we did have a much more engaged bench in the Court of Appeal than in the High Court. But be that as it may, I think, generally speaking, yes, our case and Plan B's case was, if not the first, and certainly one of the first pure climate cases to get to the Supreme Court, which is, I would add, an achievement in itself, because it's only cases of the greatest significance constitutionally and legally that get to the Supreme Court at all. So it's definitely a very good thing that a climate case has, and such a big climate case has got there. But yes, I mean, I think the idea that judges are utterly impartial and utterly objective, if you look back through the course of history, it's just, you know, not true. Judges do not operate in a vacuum. And that is why, you know, looking back at judgments from the, 19th and 18th century, you will see things that would shock you by modern standards, and they're operating and reflecting the society in which they live, and sometimes, or quite often, they're slower to catch up with things, and that's the nature of the legal system, unfortunately. But it is still possible to win sometimes, and also to achieve things even when you don't formally win, like in this case.
Great, thank you. I'll move us on so we can try and get through a few more questions. So the next question I have is from Quentin. He's also popped it in the chat box. But this is around what the implications are for our asks in London of the mayor and the GLA members in the run-up to the elections. How is that going to affect that campaign? So just for info, I'm just going to pop in our climate action plan for London, which has some stuff on that and within that we're sort of generally opposing Heathrow and City Airport expansion. There are some general asks around that in there. I don't think our asks themselves are going to change as such. It's always the plan to be pressing candidates to oppose Heathrow and City expansion, as it states within that document. It might be worth flagging it specifically, particularly if you're in a constituency which is
most adversely affected by Heathrow expansion. So if you're in Hillingdon, somewhere like that, to draw those asks out specifically, ask the candidates what their position is and if they're willing to say that they oppose it. But the asks themselves, I don't think they need to change because it's in there already, just about how we sort of draw it out and bring it to the fore where it's most where it's most sort of useful to do so. Okay, so I'll move on to a question. So this was a sort of a bit of a theme, unsurprisingly, from lots of people around the regions. Essentially, on what the sort of the implications of this case are for in terms of sort of planned expansion at other airports. So we've had people from Luton and Gatwick and Leeds, Bradford and Southampton groups all sort of flagging that. So it'd be great to hear some insights from our campaigners on that. So who would like to take that first? I'll go to Katie.
Should I just cover very briefly the planning, sort of the general comments, and then maybe Jenny can come in on some of the specific policy stuff. So just in very general terms, well, the ANPS establishes a need, so-called need for aviation expansion in the southeast. And now that it has been reinstated, that does have implications for other airport expansion in the southeast region beyond Heathrow. It will be considered a relevant consideration for decisions on expansion, for example, in Gatwick. Albeit that the ANPS identifies that the preferred scheme is Heathrow. So in terms of what this means for the projects themselves, in terms of the judgment, well, the sort of policy tests that are set out in the ANPS, including the climate test on a material impact on the ability of the UK to meet its carbon targets, for example. That's going to be in place, for example, in relation to Gatwick, which is also an NSIP, as opposed to something going in under the Town and Country Planning Act. So all the stuff in there about climate arguments being up for grabs, international aviation and needing to be factored in, all of that is going to have a bearing on decisions regarding NSIP, certainly within the southeast, like Gatwick. I think maybe Jenny would like to pop in.
Yes, I mean, as Katie says, the ANPS covers the southeast, and just to be clear, it defines that to include Heathrow and City Airport, which are the two actually in London, and then we've got Gatwick and Luton and Stansted. So that's what's covered by the ANPS. And obviously, you know, I'm aware of various schemes and proposals at varying levels of progression around the country. I've liaised with some of you, I know via Brenda on the Gatwick campaign and the South End, probably others as well. So, you know, we do what we can to help support regional opposition to schemes through your regional campaigns organisers. And I think that some of the work we try to do in the wider sort of policy, national policy work, and what we're trying to do in the transport decarb plan, and on what we will hopefully do in this net zero aviation strategy should help all of you. So that should filter through as and when things happen. So, you know, do come and ask if you need some help. We haven't got a planner on this call, but we do have a planner. I can ask specific questions of our planners and Katie and legal team, as well as Dave and the politics sort of folks. So, you know, we you know, aren't specifically working in any area except for the work we've done on Heathrow at the moment, but we can try and help through things like this and through specific questions if you want to come to us. Yes, I'm not sure particularly if there's anything else I can add to that at the moment. Thanks.
Thanks, Jenny. Okay, so this seems like a good time. I can see a couple of people have their hands up. So as we've not got masses of time left, I think we'll go to opening up the floor for people's questions and comments. What I'd like you to do is indicate in the chat box if you have a question. We'll answer as many as we can, and we'll wrap things up just around 5:30. So Felix, I see you had your hand up, so let's go to you, and then if you can pop in that you'd like to ask a question in the chat box, and we'll try and get to as many as we can in the very limited time. So Felix.
So this is a very quick question for Katie. I'm involved in the Southampton campaign, who've just updated their environmental impact statement. And they've got a specific thing related to the Supreme Court judgment. So they say, this means that for the purposes of determination of the planning application by Eastleigh Borough Council, the Paris Agreement is considered an international treaty and should not be considered as government policy, and therefore a material consideration to which regard must be held. So I guess our response to that, that actually it still matters because of the Committee of Climate Change? Is that, do you think, the strongest argument to take?
I'm not familiar with the Southampton application, I'm afraid, and I should say that I'm not a planner.
Right.
I mean, certainly in respect of the Heathrow case, the Supreme Court went out of its way to say that the government had considered the Paris Agreement. They didn't accept the finding from the Court of Appeal and the government's own submissions previously that they hadn't considered it at all. So clearly they didn't think, there was no ruling from them saying, you know, you didn't need to consider the Paris Agreement. So I don't think that the Supreme Court judgment does establish that Paris is completely irrelevant. And I think, you know, you can go back certainly on that basis.
Thank you.
And that's hope that's helpful. Some help.
Yeah, that is helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
We've got a few questions in the chat, and apologies, I've got a bit lost in the chat.
While you're doing that, Ted, I would just say that, you know, out of Paris is where we've got the net zero target from. So the fact that we have to look at net zero in relation to any application, you know, is actually a way that Paris is being taken into account. So, you know, that's in law now, and that came because of the Paris Agreement. So we're sort of using it anyway, I would say.
Right. Okay. Right, sorry, I'm a bit lost with the chat. There's a lot of stuff in there. There's been a couple of questions about Labour MPs in the chat, and Dave, if you'd like to come in on that, that'd be great.
Yes, I mean, I think for Labour MPs, I can't remember what they said, is it about jobs? And I do think it's jobs and economic growth, and especially for communities in the north, that is the justification that they paint. I think what they've been able to do is really the same lines of defence as Conservative MPs, which is that technology will come and save us at some point. Obviously, you know, climate denialism is all but extinct within Parliament in its most kind of obvious forms, but it's they do hide behind that inconvenient. That inconvenient loophole that somehow, you know, biofuel planes or battery aircraft will come and deliver this for them. I saw that particularly. I mean, Luke Pollard, who is now the Shadow Secretary of State for the Environment, when the net zero target was passed, actually said, well, this is great because it means that I think it was Plymouth. Yeah, Plymouth Airport can expand. We'll be able to have electric planes on it. So really? No, that's not the case. So yeah, using that as a way to justify it has to be said. Also, it's to do with the campaigning as well. So I think partly the way that the campaigning has happened is it's been incredibly strong opposing Heathrow within West London, the West London area, which is why, you know, politically, the position is as it is among those MPs. But what the supporters of Heathrow expansion have done is campaign outside of London. You know, so you have MPs such as Cheon Wara up in Newcastle area, who is a vociferous supporter of Heathrow, because, you know, my own union, Unite, have been campaigning at those Labour MPs to say it's really important in Newcastle for Newcastle's economic growth. So I think there's a campaigning lesson there for us, which as well, which is, you know, that the opposition has been very kind of around the area of Heathrow, which has meant that it's always been overwhelmed by the job that the supporters of Heathrow have done, which is to get MPs all over the rest of the country to support it by convincing them it's good for economic growth in their area, which of course isn't actually true, because it would be an economic sucking sound towards London and the southeast. But that's the kind of strategy they've played, and it's been a very successful one, I think. Also, I think there was one other thing on the chat which I did want to come back on, if it's okay with you, very quickly, is Anthony's point about the CCC. Yes, Anthony, you know, we wish that the CCC had gone further on this. You know, they are planning for a share of the emissions pie, which is still really big for aviation, have shied away from really kind of pushing that further. I think I'm going to go with being glass half full on this one, because I think for me, the real potential of being able to say to parliamentarians, you can't all champion airport expansion. I think if we can really fight on that and get that kind of hardwired into political thinking, we'll significantly splinter the way the MPs have been able to support each other's projects without addressing that contradiction overall. So, yeah, I think I'm going to go half full, which is unusual for me. I'm usually quite pessimistic.
Great, thank you. Did that answer your comments, Ansi, that you had in the chat box, or did you have a separate one?
Well, I just want to make a brief comment about the overall approach to aviation. I've been working on it with Friends of the Earth for the last 20 years. The, you know, both Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace, when they tackle aviation over the last decade or so, they focused upon Heathrow, and you can see the reason why, and you end up in court and you win and you lose and so forth. So I mean, that's understandable. And also, as I put in the question in the chat box, you've been a little bit too optimistic about your interpretation of what CCC are actually saying. It's the alternative strategy is to say, well, okay, Heathrow is just one site battle. Of course, it's really important because it's 50% of the emissions. But the real problem, the real enemy here, is the DfT itself. They do not intend to change their policy stance. It's really clear that they are not going to do that. And that means that for all the individual airport expansion proposals, and I'm speaking to you from West Yorkshire, where the Leeds Bradford Airport application is due to be determined next Thursday, and who knows what the officers are going to recommend. It's impossible for us to fight expansion proposals. We've been doing this at the Transport for the North level, at Leeds City Region, at West Yorkshire Combined Authority, at Leeds City Council, and Ian's on the call here, and he's led on that. It's just impossible to fight airport expansion across the country if we haven't dealt with the problem inside the DfT, rather than tackling a particular campaign, even one as important as Heathrow.
Thank you. Thanks for that, Anthony. I'm just going to go to you, Dave. I can see you've had your hand raised for quite a while. This is going to have to be the last question, I think. I think we could easily have done with another half an hour on this topic. So many people here and so many questions. But perhaps we can organise something else in the coming weeks. But you, Dave, let's go to you.
Yeah, thanks, Ted. So my question was to the political editor. when the case was filed, we still were part of probably the European Union. COVID had not happened, and but the situation now is different. Eurostar now needs bailout. Government debt is at significantly high level, and there is already an argument going on who is going to bail out Eurostar. And we have seen that differences between post-Brexit between Europe and UK can be significant. We have seen it during the vaccination program as well. And Heathrow expansion, the solicitor said that it's going to at least take about 10 years, even if we get all the permissions. During that time, especially for short-haul flights, the technology is emerging in favor of battery-operated flights, etc. So with these circumstances changing, how do you see political scenario evolving? And do you see greater support emerging in favor of expansion given these technological and political developments?
Who'd like to come in on that? Jenny?
Sorry, I was just trying to answer another question in the chat box. Could you just refresh me, just the core point of that question? I did hear half of it, but I was just trying to answer something else.
I can chip in as a starter. I might help refresh Jenny's memory.
Thank you.
My understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, is that the technology is actually, you know, some way away yet. And it's not a case of it. I think our position is, you know, show us that the technology is ready and then we can have a conversation about it, but don't put an application in on the basis of technology that isn't actually even here yet. The pie in the sky for Heathrow to be making that sort of argument. And I also think that, as you say, that there are changing circumstances, but there are changing climate circumstances as well. The further we go along, the less time we have to take the action that is needed. The IPCC's report in 2018 warned that we had 12 years and we're now, you know, start of 2021. So there's that sort of, you know, increasing urgency in that respect as well. Does that help a bit, Jenny, for you to?
Yes. Thank you, Katie. Yes, basically that's it. There are some promising things, but at the moment they're very much small scale for electric, not very heavy, not very far. But, you know, things do change and where there's a need, that can drive innovation. There are some other sort of thoughts about different fuels and synthetic fuels and worries about how hydrogen might be made and the whole carbon capture issue is still very much a live one. And obviously we're very against the offsetting idea because basically offsetting has been shown to be largely not realistic either. It should have happened anyway, so you couldn't count it as additional and therefore count it to count against something else you increase emissions on. So there are huge issues and therefore demand management is still the best. Frequent flyer levy is something we support where it's basically more as a sort of pay as you go. At the moment, it's a relatively few people who account for the large majority of the flights. It's very unequal. A lot of people don't fly at all. So, you know, it is a question of sort of sharing out better and fairly what flying can be done. But as I said, even, you know, the CCC are talking about having quite a lot of residual emissions from aviation left, and that would have to be somehow either sucked out of the air through carbon capture, because basically the offsetting we shouldn't be doing, and the carbon capture is also needed for probably more essential things like offsetting carbon sort of gas boilers, that sort of thing. So we really do have to do the demand management. That's where we're coming from. We need to shift the demand away, and certainly frequent flyer levy is one of the key ways to do that.
Great, thank you, Jenny.
Okay, we have gone over time, so I'm going to have to wrap things up. So we do have a number of your questions that you submitted before, and we've got everything that's written in the chat. So we will endeavour to respond to all the questions that have been submitted and get responses to those sent out to you. A lot of these things might also be answered in a couple of our briefings, which we'll send around as well afterwards. But that's all we've got time for tonight. So thanks everyone so much for coming. Thanks to our speakers for sharing all their insights. It's really great to see everybody here. And we will be in touch with you about the next steps on the Heathrow campaign as soon as we know them. So stay tuned. Okay, brilliant, everyone. Have a good rest of your evening. And thank you much for everything you're doing. And we'll speak to you all soon. Take care, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck with all the different campaigns.
Yeah, keep going, everyone. Keep going. Guys.
Thank you, Ted and everybody. Bye.
Nice to see you all.
Cheers, Nick.
Bye.
Anthony just